Hello one and all. Welcome to another episode of Turkey Book Talk. I'm the host, William Armstrong. In this podcast, I talk to authors about newly released books on Turkey and its neighbourhood. Subscribe to Turkey Book Talk on iTunes, Podbean or Stitcher, or you can follow via the Facebook page, or subscribe at my website, armstrongwilliam.wordpress.com. If you enjoy this podcast and you want to support it and me, you can do so via my Patreon account, making a small or large monetary donation on a per episode basis. Check out details of how to do that through all the Turkey Book Talk pages. But now let's get cracking with the latest show. And in this episode, I speak to Ali Yaycıoğlu of Stanford University, the author of Partners of the Empire, The Crisis of the Ottoman Order in the Age of Revolutions, which examines a crucial era of reform and revolution in the Ottoman Empire at the turn of the 18th and 19th centuries. In the conversation, we discuss what form these changes took at the time, their long-term effects, and what they can tell us about contemporary Turkey's turbulent political landscape. But I started by asking Ali Yaycıoğlu to place the Ottoman Empire in the context of wider revolutionary upheavals going on at the time in Europe and elsewhere.
Instead of arguing or telling the story that, you know, how European upheavals affected the Ottoman Empire, I try to understand the Ottoman experience in a larger global context of different upheavals and political, social, economic crises. For a long time, actually, European history and of Age of Revolutions were handled separately as a kind of a very much European phenomenon. And then from the 1960s onwards, people started to talk about the Atlantic revolutions, like seeing American and French revolutions or Haiti, for instance, in the same Atlantic context. But then there's a new wave of thinking in last 10, 15 years, thinking the world, in fact, altogether, what we call the Age of Revolutions, namely different turmoils, different institutional transformations and different settlements, different crises, in fact, happening concurrently in different parts of the world, from China, Eurasian context, and Atlantic world in Americas, and how different political legal cultures responded to these challenges. So my work is, it's not just, okay, there was a revolutionary age in Europe and there was a revolutionary age in the Ottoman Empire. On the contrary, I dissenter the European centered, Euro-centered Age of Revolutions and tell the Ottoman experience in this very shaky period. And in a way, see the Ottoman experience and European experience and other experiences in the same global context. Is it possible? Well, there are some limits of like writing a global history. Mine is not like a global history per se, but the idea was to ask questions that we normally ask the European revolutions. In the late 18th, early 19th century, to the Ottoman context, but probably receive different answers. And then, in a way, tell the historians what the Ottoman experience will tell us about the Age of Revolutions, which how the Ottoman experience might change our ideas about this major period where modernity, in a way, started. So this is the main idea.
I guess much of the book focuses on Sultan Selim III, who came to the throne in 1789, and he was a reformer of sorts, and he came up with this program of changes, which is known in English as the New Order, or Nizami Cedid. What was his aim with these reforms, and what did they intend to achieve?
Well, it's not only Selim III, obviously. Selim III is the patron of the reform agenda, if you will, and patron of the reformers. Reform was an interesting phenomenon. And in the 18th century, actually, more or less everywhere in the world, there are some people, sometimes bureaucrats, sometimes, if you will, like some scholars, they talked about the reform, reforming the order. reforming the order. In fact, in the French case, for instance, you know, Louis the 16th was a big reformer, although he became the victim of the French Revolution. In fact, his career started as a reformer. George III in Britain during the same period was a big reformer. So reform agenda in general in the late 18th century was to reform the military and administrative structure. And while doing that, you need to deal with the opposition. You need to deal with the vested rights and vested interests. So this is the dilemma that, you know, on the one hand, Selim III, I mean, then, and his cadre, they wanted to change the order, military order and administrative order, make it more efficient. You know, they were inspired by, say, the new military engineering. So they want to just introduce this new military engineering methods in the army. Or they are interested in new forms of tax collection. But reform, in fact, challenged the existing order. And in the existing order, there are lots of vested interests, different groups that they don't want change, or they wanted change, but they, you know, they have their own agenda of change. So it's a change of the order. Changing the order is a very like difficult and complex process, and there are lots of negotiations. In the Ottoman case, the Ottoman reformers, they had some idea about reform, and they were sure that, okay, the military structure didn't respond to the the needs of the time. But then they didn't come up with a very, like, they don't agree on one project. There were lots of projects, you know, put on the table. What I found out, actually, the Ottoman reformers, they didn't agree on more or less anything. Administrative reform, would it be a reform for centralization, or would it be a reform for a kind of a, which trigger another kind of integration with this decentralization? Would the provincial actors be included in the state, the new reformed structure, or they will be excluded? Since the Janissaries were a very like prestigious core and, you know, one of the pillars of the Ottoman state, would reform include Janissaries, or Janissaries should be out of the reform and they left out? What, you know, about the foreign trade, would they have a more like strict economic policy on trade, you know, to collect taxes, or would they allow more a free market? So what I found, in fact, reformers, they didn't agree on one project. There were lots of reform agendas on the table. And which one would be prevail? Well, this is a process. I mean, the reform is a political negotiation, is a political process, which included lots of give and takes, lots of concessions, lots of tensions, lots of, at the same time, alliances and coalitions, both by, you know, among the reformers or among the opposition of the reforms, and lots of people who are constantly switching sides. So it's a kind of a very complex process. Selim III, he knew that, and he's with his cadre, they knew that reform was necessity, and there's no way that, you know, the Ottoman Empire survived without reforming the administrative and, you know, military system. Like, you know, it was a necessity also, as I said, in France, in Britain, in India. But they didn't agree on one simple, one coherent project. And when the reform process started with the creating a new army, this was, there was an agreement about that. In fact, creating a new army is a good option. But they didn't agree on, the reformers didn't agree on how how big would be this army? You know, what would be the, you know, the local organization of the army? So things took place throughout the time, and in each time you have different negotiations. Eventually, the reform party, the whole thing collapsed. But this is also very common, as you know, the whole French Revolution is about the reform agenda of the Louis XVI collapse. I mean, this is the reason that was the revolution. So in the Ottoman Empire, you have the same story. There was a reform agenda, which included various competing sub-agendas, if you like, different versions of reform agendas. So within the reform party, there was also no homogeneous agreement. And there was a serious opposition to the reform. Why there was an opposition to the reform? Because people generally don't... People had interests, they acquired lots of rights, lots of privileges, and reform would challenge these acquired, privileges and rights. So, like other places in the Ottoman context, urban communities, janissaries, which controlled urban public opinion, certain peasant communities, they were very suspicious towards this unpredictable changes coming from the state. So I try to, in a way, go beyond this old historiography, saying that, well, the reform is really about westernization and the opposition coming from more conservative and sometimes reactionary powers, mainly the janissaries and the ulema. This narrative, the westernization versus conservative reaction, this narrative prolonged for many, many years, and it really occupied our agendas, our way of thinking of the Ottoman Empire. So I tried to present another picture, and I argued that, well, this is like in other places, there was a reform agenda, and in this agenda there are lots of competing versions of what reform should be, how reform should be. And since, there were lots of groups, lots of people, lots of individuals and collectivities who acquired lots of interest and privileges and rights, they were challenged, they were threatened by this reform agenda, they opposed to the reform agenda. And then after this tension, this tension between those, who wanted to reform and those who opposed, so you never know which direction things would go. This is, I think, so we don't know. And then reforms can, there can be still reform. And eventually, Ottoman reforms became successful in a way. But this is a politics of reform. So you don't know which direction things should go, right? I mean, many contingent factors, negotiations, political processes took place. And this is what I want to show in the book. There is no one tight shirt narrative of reform and opposition to the reform. When the reform started, you never know what's going to happen.
You mentioned there the Janissaries, and they were this kind of elite group of soldiers, and they were very influential over centuries in the Ottoman Empire. And they became this kind of locus of opposition or resistance because they had a lot of vested interests and they'd acquired various privileges over time. I mean, what role did they play? I mean, there was this extraordinary period that you describe over the course of 1807 and 1808, where there was this massive political crisis. Selim III was overthrown in a Janissary-inspired rebellion, and then there was a counter coup, and then the Janissaries were suppressed, and it's all rather confusing. what were the results of this upheaval, and what kind of order emerged after 1808?
Yeah, this is. This crisis, in fact, started in 1806 in Edirne. That was when the new army tried to enter into the Balkans. There was this opposition in the Balkans. It was a coalition of Janissaries and some local dynasties. They blocked the new army in Edirne, and then they didn't let the army go deep into the Balkans. This was very, very interesting. The Ottoman army was blocked by the Ottoman people in Edirne. So this was the start of the beginning of the crisis. And then there was this multiple events, incidents, episodes, which was it's very complex, as you said, very, very complicated process. And but it was, the whole episode 1806, 1807 and 8 were seen as a kind of a revolutionary time during the by the contemporary authors. The people now who experienced these events, actually, who saw, witnessed this events, they knew that there's something similar going on in the Ottoman Empire, like in other parts of the world. I mean, this is really a major crisis, which lots of bloodshed and terror and violence and also conspiracies. This is also a little bit like, I would say, you know, the what we have seen in Turkey in this last 3-4 years. You know, you might find some similarities. Maybe.
I wanted to talk about that.
The Janissaries, the Janissaryship is very interesting. Janissary hood, if you like. Janissary identity. I mean, it's not something that we are familiar in our modern times, so it's difficult to comprehend. What I define Janissary is a kind of a combination of, if you will, and it's an army. Yes, it is an army, and its own like army culture and core culture. But at the same time, it was like a union. It's huge. It's like we're talking about like 400,000 Janissaries in total. I mean, this number is not maybe reliable. I mean, we don't know the exact number of the Janissaries throughout the empire. But, we are really talking about like a couple of hundred thousands of Janissaries or those who claim to be Janissaries. So it's like a huge kind of social strata. And they negotiated with the state and with the authorities about their salaries, about their privileges. So they as like a union, like a labor union. But this also, they also act like a political party in addition to those, because they don't only represent their own corporate interests. They claimed that they in fact represent something more than they represent, which is they in a way they claim that they represent the commoners, the people, the laws, the order, the old order, the sometimes, you know, they claim to represent the poor. Depends on the, you know, different episodes and different, you know, different occasions. So they go, I mean, they present themselves as the guardians of conventions and laws. And they also, since they were founded very early, like the Janissary Corps, so they were one of the partners of the empire, and they were the pillars of the empire. I mean, this very prestigious corps we're talking about. So they combine this prestige, this historical prestige, with their economic social power, with their also privileges that they acquired through times. So then it's difficult also to understand, because at the same time Janissaries were in the state, they're part of the state, but at the same time they represent the opposition. So these two things come together here. Like they were the opposition, main dissent, main opposition, or if there's an opposition, mainly you have to mobilize the Janissaries. But at the same time they were part and in the state. So they are not against the state in a way, because they're part of the state, but they also they can be against certain things within the state, and they claim to represent broader interests, of the people and of the state. The reforms, military reforms, obviously challenged the Janissaries. I mean, there was no question about that. And the reforms knew this. Because if the Ottoman Empire established a new army based on new military technology in the 18th century, obviously the old Janissary military culture became void, can become useless. So Janissaries knew this. I mean, there's no way that they didn't understand. They understood the threat. And they opposed that, and they had their own, you know, point. I mean, they developed certain other arguments. They, you know, they opposed to be part of this new military order, because, for instance, in the new military order, you have daily training. But most of the Janissaries had shops in the market, so they cannot really join the daily training. So there were some concessions that they can make. But this would not be enough to create a new or to reform the Janissary army. So that was a dilemma here. So then what Janissaries did, they said, well, look, I mean, we represent something bigger than the military culture. This is their argument. We represent something broader. We represent the rights. We represent the commoners. This was their argument. So they made like moral argument, if you like, moral, legal, legit argument for the legitimate order, referring history, referring laws, referring the founding principles of the empire. And the New Orderists, they said, well, this doesn't work. So we have to deal with this. And since we cannot get rid of the Janissary army, we need to create a new army. The revolutions happened in 1807 and 1808 because this is not only, as you might see here, this is not only a military question. This is a social question. The Janissaries were so much integrated into the society. So in a way, to challenge the Janissaryship means to challenge this all, like the social order itself. And to create a new army is not only creating a new army. It's creating a new disciplinary mechanism to create a new organization. And this organization can be army, but can be also this city, for instance, that I discussed, if you remember, Selimiye, which is a barrack, military barracks, but in fact it was a city, it's a new city. So then the whole argument about military engineering and but also the mujaddidis, although religious activism came into the picture, like, you know, I discussed this, Ubaydullah Kushmani, who was a Naqshbandi mujaddidi preacher, who came up with a very strong argument about how to discipline a body, and, you know, accused the Janissaries that in fact Janissary culture created a situation where human bodies were not disciplined and they're loose and they were lazy. They don't know how to fight, but they don't even how to pray. So this new order gradually transformed from a military reform agenda into a social agenda to reform the society, and gradually an agenda to discipline the body itself, body and the souls. So I wrote a new article about this, particularly this religious aspect of it. I entitled it Guarding Conventions and Laws versus Disciplining Bodies and Souls. So this was the dilemma here, the conflict. In these 2 years, multiple actors were involved with their calculations of interests and with their ideas about how should the Ottoman Empire be, how it should be reformed. And these ideas, these agendas were constantly renegotiated, shifted. It's a very complex process. You cannot just find out very static groups and, you know, having very clear and non-changing ideas. Ideas are, and agendas are constantly changing and renegotiated, like political alliances. And eventually you have these three major events in 1807 that was in May. That was a Janissary revolution, which ended the new order. And then in 1808, in August, that was a conspiracy and then a coup by the new orderist in alliance with the provincial notable families. And in 1808, November, that was another Janissary revolution, which was the bloodiest because of this big fire in Istanbul, devastating one third of the city, where the new order was abolished again, second times. So there are three major revolutions and zigzags. And and then I focus on this particular document after the second revolution or second coup, the Deed of Alliance, which is a very important document. So I dedicated a whole chapter on that. But the story, in fact, I ended the book with the, you know, November 1808 in a way, but the story continued, obviously. And then in 1926, the Janissary Corps was abolished, and there was a massacre that many Janissaries were killed by the people of Istanbul, in fact, and by the new militia of the Mahmud II. So the story continued. I ended my book in 1808,
And you mentioned there before about, reading this book and about all this intrigue and the coups and counter-coups and whatnot. You can't help but be reminded of contemporary Turkey. What do you think are some of the lessons, or what do you think this period of history can teach us about the present?
Well, many things that I wrote in the book, in fact, that I realized can be relevant for contemporary Turkey. Like, think about confiscations, which was my main, you know, I did all, and my new book is about confiscations. So, you know, today Turkey, you know, confiscations became very, very important, right, to what's going on after the coup attempt, or before even. Or the military question still is there. The role of Naqshbandi and Mujaddidi preachers, I mean, this was a big aspect of the, not a big, I mean, then I wrote a couple of articles on that. In the book, I dwell on that, but it was, I didn't get to details. But then I wrote articles on Mujaddidi and Naqshbandi preachers and their role in the reform, military reform, and the way that they infiltrated into the new order and everything. So I argue that, in fact, there was a discursive alliance between the military engineering and this new Islamic activism spreading from India in the 18th century. This what we call Mujaddidi movement, the renewers. And now in the coup, obviously, you know, the Gulenist network, in fact, were one of the descendants of the so-called Mujaddidi network and the Mujaddidi movement. In fact, there's a lineage from Gulen to Imam Rabbani. So many things in a way continued. So kind of interesting. The biggest lesson is this. My book is in a way about, eventually about a settlement, a failed settlement, right? Deed of Alliance was a document to put an end to crisis. But this is also a document of concessions. It's a settlement document. Settlement, in this case, between provincial notable families and Ottoman bureaucrats. And also a little bit like the Janissaries. It was a settlement to include people, more or less everybody, that, you know, it claimed to include everybody, and to create a kind of a unity, a settlement and unity. What I realized looking from that document onwards in the 19th and 20th century, the Turkish, Ottoman Turkish political culture, in fact, severely failed to have settlements. Settlements that, you know, didn't work in the Ottoman political and then Turkish political culture. There were attempts for settlements, but these didn't continue long. And then the powerful took over. This happened during the early Republic. This happened during the, you know, before the time of Mahmud II. And this is now happening now. I mean, the powerful and the those who are able to eliminate others would eliminate others and wanted to impose himself and did not get into, and they don't want to make concession and establish a settlement with others. And for that reason, without settlement, the rules, the stability continued very short. And then there was another crisis, and another attempt of the settlement, and this settlement also failed. So the, you know, Turkish, Ottoman Turkish history can be written as a history of failed settlements. What happened after the coup, there was another chance for a settlement, I think, a kind of an alliance, a kind of a possibility for a partnership. What they call in these days is Yeni Kapı Ruhu, for instance. But now it is, now we see that, in fact, it doesn't work. It will fail again. So this is a big lesson and an ugly lesson. I don't think, you know, is it like, I don't know what is the reason for it. I mean, is it like a political cultural reason, or is it about, like, because of the institutions? But this was recurring, constantly recurring. Settlements, there were moments for settlements, there were possibilities for political settlements, but they didn't get through, they didn't continue, and then they failed. And then, as I said, there was another period of stability, maybe because a powerful, some leader or a government took control, but then another crisis, well, you know, is inevitable because this powerful government didn't come with settlement. There was another crisis, and then there was another, sometimes this crisis produced coups, and then another moment of settlement, possibility of settlement, and another failure. Turkish political leaders should, I think, should have a very, I mean, politicians in Turkey particularly should get lessons from history and should know history well. And in sort of glorification, I think they should understand first and foremost, this destiny, which, prevailed for 200 years in the Turkish and Ottoman Turkish political culture. Why there was no settlement and continued instability in this country? Why different groups somehow constantly they came together, but they failed to sustain a partnership? I think this is something to think of. If the Turkish leaders really want to make a big change in Turkish history, I think they should think about this.
That was Ali Yaycıoğlu. You can find a link to my Hürriyet Daily News review of his book, Partners of the Empire, The Crisis of the Ottoman Order in the Age of Revolutions, over at my website, armstrongwilliam.wordpress.com. Remember, you can subscribe to Turkey Book Talk via iTunes, Podbean or Stitcher. If you enjoy this podcast, don't forget to rate it on iTunes or Stitcher or like the Facebook page, which helps other people find the show. Also, remember that you can support the podcast via my Patreon account, donating on a per-episode basis. Many thanks to current supporters Andrew Cruikshank, Özlem Bey Arslan, Steve Bryant and Aaron Ataman. But for now, until the next episode, thank you very much for listening.